Fossils and Fiction, a show about ancient life, paleontology, and the stories we tell. The show is produced by me, Travis Holland, on Wiradjuri Country, with the support of Charles Sturt University. Enjoy! Jack O'Connor is a PhD researcher at the Evans Evo Lab at Monash University. Jack undertakes a fascinating mix of research and creative work. We chatted about their journey into and through paleo research. Hi, Jack. Welcome to Fossils and Fiction. Now, you've had an interesting journey in and through science at Monash Uni. Why were you drawn to paleo?
Great question, Travis. Thank you very much for having me. I'm not really sure, I suppose. I think that, like a lot of people, when I was younger, I was very, very drawn to extinct life and mm-hmm. animals. For me, it wasn't necessarily like the whole dinosaur kid stereotype. It was more of the, I just loved everything. I loved the megafauna and the old weird bug life and things like that. And I have always kind of wanted to work with animals. So it wasn't necessarily for me a whole, let's just do paleo. But as soon as it came up, what I love about it is the sort of the chance to study animals that are still mysterious, don't have a chance to actually view in real life in the world around us, and kind of answer some questions through a bit of detective work, which is fun.
So you mentioned when it came up, was it a major in your science degree? What course did you actually do there as an undergrad?
So I did a science advanced science communication course here at Monash mm-hmm. Uni called Global Challenges. It's an honours degree. It's for 4 years, and I absolutely loved it. A fantastic degree. And I did my major on conservation biology. So I was very, very interested in sort of studying that ecology side of things. I did a lot of zoology subjects as well, mm-hmm. trying to make sure that I'm learning as much about that as I can. I'm still extremely passionate about that sort of thing because, well, paleontology, it's not really studied in very many places around here. And I think that even if it had been a major, I really wanted to get that zoological background so that I, even if I went into this field, that's the sort of thing that I'm looking at because in reality, they are just animals that just happen to be weird.
Yeah, that's often something I think that is forgotten about, by especially by kind of dinosaur fans, right? Like, obviously, the scientists know it there, but talking about extinct animals as just animals, ultimately, still existing on this planet in their natural environments and doing all the things that animals today do, is something that's sometimes lost in those conversations. So yeah, it's nice to see, I think, that link between modern zoology and as you say, conservation biology and paleo. Tell me a little bit more about that honours project then. You did some sort of creative work in that, as I understand.
Yes, so the honours program in Global Challenges is a little different to if people are familiar with honours in science usually. It's a group project. You have to write two theses, sort of one each semester, and it is traditionally a sort of industry honours. They partner mm-hmm. you with a organization. You don't traditionally get to choose what your honors project is. You're sort of just given something that is within your field. It's meant to expand your horizons, essentially.
That's kind of separate to the traditional one-year individual research project, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, it is still 1 year, but it is, for most people, far more of like a consulting kind of thing than it mm-hmm. is a traditional research project. For me, I wanted it to be more of a traditional research project, so I got in touch with a lab here under Alastair Evans here at Monash University, and we did a little bit of shenanigans, I suppose is the to essentially get the Tasmanian Museum and Art Gallery and his former student David Hocking who was now the curator there of vertebrate zoology, to apply to be one of the industry partners for Global Challenges. And we set up a project that way. It was super amazing. And yes, it's all very science communication focused. So even though I did end up working on a research project and it was extremely fun, it was very much trying to make sure that it's always tying back into how do we present things for the museum to use? How do we communicate it for both their audience, but also their stakeholders, and trying to be as encompassing that way as possible.
Yeah. Look, being an academic myself and trying to set up these industry projects, I think you probably got an insight into how the sausage is made, perhaps, but it's probably not that uncommon for exactly that to happen, that an academic says, this is the project we want. Let's find an industry partner that can do it, because often industry doesn't know how to approach universities. So I'm not misrepresenting, but I reckon you're not the only project that actually where that exact thing basically happened. It just might be that you were aware of it and others weren't.
Oh, look, that's very, very likely. But I think that it was just very, very fun, and it was an amazing opportunity to actually work on something that has real immediate consequences, essentially, of like what you're doing is going into this place, it is being shown, it is being exhibited, and it's trying to make sure that you are as rigorous with the science as possible, but also trying to expand that science communication aspect.
So what did you actually put out? What was the product that went into the gallery?
The museum? Great question. I suppose I probably should say what it was. So what happened was that there was a very, very complete skeleton of a marsupial megafauna animal called Zygomaturus, sort of a slightly smaller cousin of Diprotodon, which more people are probably familiar with. This thing had a big bulk, very weird head, weird nose. And they took it off display about 10 years ago and put it all through a CT scanner. But nobody had really touched the data or anything like that. And the specimen had last been described almost exactly 100 years ago in a monogram. So none of that had really happened. And what our project was trying to do whatever we wanted with that so that we could pretty much put a new display on for the for TMAG, the Tasmanian Museum and Art. I ended up focusing on the reconstruction. So I did a lot of skeletal reconstruction, rearticulation, and then extending that to trying to understand the muscles a little bit, sculpting out the body, doing a study on marsupial hair density and hair length and colors, and building all of these like 3D articulations and reconstructions to have a sort of a walking Zygomaturus animation and asset to be able to put into this final exhibit, which was pretty much our final deliverable.
We will come back to those reconstructions, but the next step, I know it's pretty early, but you're doing a PhD now. So what's that shaping up like?
Another great question. Yes, it is slightly pretty early, but
it's the horror question for any PhD student.
that is certainly true, but I think for me, I just love talking about it because it's the reason why I'm doing it. Something that I have passed my first 6-month milestone at this point, and hopefully we've got a little bit of an idea of what's happening. I almost certainly things will change, major or minor, as we go through. But right now, the PhD is focusing on reconstructing Australian giant marine reptiles from the Cretaceous period, with a focus on our pliosaurs and polycotyledons, which are two essentially sister groups to the plesiosaurs, which are those like long-necked, big four-flipped things that swam around that most people have seen or are aware of at this point, I think.
Plesiosaurs were some of the first really large fossils to be dug up, I think, in the Western world, in England, right, by Mary Anning and others. So is that, are those plesiosaurs on your shirt? Or...
Yes, they are, yeah. I'm trying to be as wrapping of my studies, species in quotation marks as I can.
You're always very stylish. If we can just take that diversion, your Instagram is full of these photos of you in wonderful shirts, I have to say.
Thank you very much, Travis. I definitely had zero expectation that would be a profile type that I would be leaning into. But hey, I love it. I'm very big into good paleo merch, whether it be supporting others or maybe making my own one day. So you know what? It's happening.
Great. So, all right, we've mentioned your reconstructions. You are known now, I think, getting a bit of a reputation for these reconstructions and 3D animations and things online. Certainly, that's the work of yours that I have seen. Why is that an important part of your life? And you said then maybe making your own paleo merch one day. So I'm getting this real sense of artistic vision to you as well.
Yes. I have never, almost in my life, ever even entertained the possibility of being an artist. I'm absolutely rubbish at drawing. I can't even, I couldn't even try. But what I love is the science communication aspect. So it sort of started out as, what am I going to do to elevate my PowerPoint presentations for things? I'm always looking to challenge myself to make my next PowerPoint presentation have either a new gimmick in it for some reason or just a different type of focus or something like that. I love pushing the boundaries of it. And that's kind of what happened. I fell into a bit of a rabbit hole with learning this free open source software called Blender, which is a 3D modeling and animation software. And my industry supervisor, David Hocking, was very familiar with it. And we sort of decided on a few things. And then it was kind of mentioned, hey, you know what would be really cool? We could do some like animations or things like that. They fully, I think, didn't expect that to be part of the scope of the project, but I decided to lean into it anyway. And let me tell you, having your first animation that you ever make be a full 3D rigged animated skeleton sculpt with 200 bones and 5 million digital hairs is not easy. Probably not something I would recommend anyone try, but it was so fun. And I realized pretty early on after talking with paleo artists and people who are very prominent in that field, like Peter Trussler, other people of his ilk, although he is the master, that there aren't many people working in a 3D space. There aren't many people that are doing that and actually crossing the boundary between it is art, but it's also something that could be used for research, like putting these models into simulations or trying to understand range of motion and things like that. It's almost like a sort of feeding two birds with one seed kind of situation. You're crossing things out as you go, multitasking, and it's always a challenge, which I enjoy.
It's something I've mentioned a few times, but those animations are really important for biomechanics studies and for understanding how animals actually moved. And this is where kind of my interest crossover is. I think Jurassic Park was the early wireframes of the Tyrannosaurus, the animators could see how the animal should be moving at that scale and size, and doing it in a way that other people hadn't necessarily done. But they were bringing basically the movie-making tools to bear on this interesting question of how actually did T-Rex walk, you know?
Yes.
That's a demonstration, but now anybody can access these tools. But still, it takes a certain level of persistence, of passion, I guess, to start using the tools, and some determination of you, as you've pointed out, to just get the details right if you're doing it for a scientific purpose. So, yeah, I think that passion must be hiding there for you if you've continued to pursue it. So That's great. And certainly, you know, I've been very impressed by the ones that I've seen popping up all over the place. So
thank you very much.
What role do you think the reconstructions bring to communicate paleo or for science in general?
I think that they hold, they fill a little bit of a gap, you know, I believe, because especially for here in Australia, we have animals that I don't necessarily think are very well recognized worldwide,
mm-hmm.
and or even by people in Australia most of the time. I think that it is extremely easy when you're in this field and you're surrounded by other people working on this sort of stuff. It's very easy to forget slightly that other people aren't. And that, yes, you're being surrounded by all these things, and we can mention the words like Mutabarosaurus, or we can mention Diprotodon, or Genyornis, or all these weird names, and we sort of understand roughly what's going on, but the general public might not, and things like documentaries, you just mentioned Jurassic Park, things like that, there's such a visual way of tying a name or a concept to a type of animal, because it takes it from a rock or a research paper that very few people will look at and instantly understand what's going on, to something that they can move around on their own, they can scale, they can zoom, they can pause it, they can play it, they can see it swimming or walking, and they can get a bit of a sense of scale without even having to do 50 hours of paleo background to try and understand what's going on. And I think it really does help in that way.
You also do some work as a SciComm presenter. I spotted on one of your profiles. What kind of work do you do there?
It's a little bit multifaceted. I work with Skype a Scientist, which is an organization that sort of pairs you with schools around the world, and you talk a little bit about your crazy work and what Australian fossils and Australian animals are like, and tying that all together. That's really fun. I also love giving sort of small workshops on these kinds of programs. So learning how to make 3D models in PowerPoint, in Blender, learning how to elevate those sorts of presentations or create animations that are a little bit mind-blowing to look at, but in reality, just a kind of a few tips and tricks to get it to work. And it's so fun. It's so fun to be able to take those concepts, and especially these sort of free programs that I want people to be able to access, and I want people to not have to spend $200 to get to a point where they're happy, and be able to show their work no matter what it is.
I think it's really important to always be thinking about how we ensure that the public's interested in the science as well, right? How those stories are told and how they break through, how they inspire people. Even if you're telling a fictional story, I think you can still use that as a wedge or an opening to get people interested. And to go off and do further research. And so, yeah, that can be really important. But how do you approach that dual responsibility? Do you think there's an issue there or a challenge in both creating and sharing the knowledge with the public? So, you know, going out and doing the original research, but then being the one to communicate it as well. Is that a challenge in keeping those things in balance?
Yes, it is. I think that a lot of researchers, especially the ones that I've talked to throughout their career, have faced that challenge in a way that they just sort of see it as very difficult to keep it going.
Mm-hmm.
There are challenges. There are things like the level of rigor that you want for describing a fossil in a publication is not the sort of level of detail that you want to be giving to a general audience. It's the sort of thing that if someone is studying that, it's extremely useful and you want that information out there and publicly accessible. But if you're throwing around the words of the different bones of the skull for the public, they're just going to get bored or confused, and it is a bit of a fine line. The biggest challenge I have found is that for a lot of paleontologists, there is a very big emphasis on, I hesitate to use the word secrecy, but a hesitancy to talk about anything until it is published, and for good reason, yeah. For some things, because, I mean, there's been history of scoops and whatnot. I think that, for me, I like to bring people onto that journey as much as I can.
Yeah.
And I think that there are ways of doing it without compromising that. I think that you can be more open about the process, you can be more collaborative, and you can be less, closed off to working with other teams if you're trying to actually focus on not just giving the best or whatever scientific research paper that is, but also just talking with people and making sure that it's not closing doors and that it is actually still being accessible. Because I think that a lot of researchers think that just an open source research paper is as accessible as it needs to be. And I think that 99% of people in the world will never and have never read a research paper in their life. So it's good to have something extra as a, yeah. that is important, but it's not the only thing.
Yeah, open published papers absolutely is important, you're right. But also, they're still full of jargon. They're still inaccessible in lots of ways. They still, yes, contain detail that people are not interested in rightly unless they're in the field and also working on those specific animals even. And so you then need to find a way to translate that into readable blog posts and videos and podcasts and art and whatever it happens to be, and all of that takes extra resources as well. Like that's just an obvious fact of it, but it's an important consideration if we do assume that the point of doing science is to get the information out to the public, especially the public that funds it quite often. So, Jack, this has been a really interesting conversation. I don't want to keep you too long, but I do want to continue to address that kind of question, right? The, you know, that issue potentially of scooping, as you mentioned, I guess there's a fear as well of getting out ahead of the standard process of peer review. You know, what if you've come to a conclusion that other experts don't agree with? That can be potentially embarrassing, and obviously that's something people are worried about in terms of information coming out before it's published. Even then, in the past couple of years, we've seen a couple of high-profile documentaries that have come out prior to research being published, one on the tennis site in South America, in America, yes, the southern US, and another on the large, I think it was a plesiosaur in England. Mm-hmm. That was discovered quite recently. And those, I think, both came out either just before or with the published papers. And so, that's an instance in which that public communication was baked in. But both of those became slightly controversial for different reasons as well. So, mm-hmm, yeah, it's a major challenge.
It is indeed a major challenge. And I truly could not give an answer that would be 100% correct in any way. I think that, yeah, honestly, there's not a, especially with the culture of research papers right now, there isn't one way to do it. But my perspective has almost always been that we should not be treating the public as lesser than researchers, because they might be less familiar with this research and with this jargon. They are an critically important part of this, and it is, we don't necessarily have to be talking about, sometimes for published papers, the important things are like, oh, is there's this morphological characteristic that sets it apart as a different species or whatever we can find. We don't necessarily have to be focusing on that sort of thing. There are stories to be told that are not just focusing on that. focusing on the discoveries of specimens and like that, the sort of Pliosaur documentary where they're looking at the skull, yes, they do focus on the kind of, here are some biomechanical techniques, here are some tooth pressure, FEA, it's like biting force type of things, here are some swimming robots of plesiosaurs, here are some other ways of studying it. And that sort of thing is fantastic because it gives the public an interest, a visual interest, a tactile interest, without necessarily spoiling specific findings or allowing that sort of thing. Now, the problem is, of course, that you do get a situation where some people are still going to be informed by just the mere mention of techniques, and that can make an issue. And I think that that's going to be an ongoing issue regardless, but I don't think that should stop us from being willing to talk about the process as it's happening.
Thank you for your insights. I know those questions were kind of unexpected, so I appreciate your willingness to engage in that discussion. Right. Jack, if people want to follow your work and follow your PhD journey, see some of those reconstructions that we've mentioned, what's the best way to do that?
At the moment, probably the best way to do that is to sort of follow my Instagram. It's a bit of a hodgepodge of lots of different things, but I try to keep people updated with various works or reconstructions. And even if you, as I said, even if you get bored by the sort of plesiosaur jargon, if that ever comes up, I hope it doesn't. But there will always be other research reconstructions on the side that I'm working on that are more than happy to go through.
Thanks, Jack, for that great conversation. Make sure you check out Jack's Instagram account, PaleoJack, PaleoJac. Thanks for listening. Find more info on the web at fossilsfiction.co and across social media. Follow and rate us on your favourite podcasting platform. If you have a story to share on the podcast, please get in touch. The theme music is Sonora by Lucas Moreira.